Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
As sports keeps coming back, so does your chance to bet on them with our exclusive wagering partner, BetOnline.ag. Major League Baseball and the NBA are in full swing, and there are no shortage of ways to get in on the action. BetOnline has all the odds, futures, and props for you to bet on. Also, tune in as Floyd Money Mayweather joins the BetOnline team in a new segment called The Ice is Right, where he talks about his expansive jewelry collection. He'll give you the chance to win some great prizes and bet on the cost of his bling. Visit BetOnline.ag today to check out all the odds and up-to-date sports news. Don't forget to sign up and take advantage of all the Welcome Back to Sports bonuses. BetOnline, your online wagering experts.
You are listening to The Bird Calls on the Armchair All-American Network. For more on your Pelicans, go to iTunes, search The Bird Calls, and subscribe today.
What's up, Pels fans? Welcome to another episode of the Bird Calls podcast. I'm your host and contributor to thebirdrights.com, as well as Bleacher Report, Preston Ellis. Today, we are talking with editor-in-chief to thebirdrights.com, the title Terminator, Mr. Ollie Cosell. What's up?
Yeah, that's a good intro, because I saw David talking with Louis Dijon
about
titles, and you know, yeah. Prejean, yeah, and so my ears just naturally perked up, so yeah, I don't know. That's good, because I freak out about titles, man. Sometimes I'll spend way too long trying to figure out something good.
Well, I appreciate you writing my titles. I used to, you know, spend, I don't know, 20 minutes coming up with a title, and then you would just axe it, so now I just don't fill it out at all, and it saves me that 20 minutes. Perfect. All right, we'll move right along. The man who always goes hard in the paint. He had some terrific episodes this past week. Mr. David Grubb, I was particularly interested in the Brian Nader podcast. I learned a lot about those guys that I didn't previously know. So nice job this week, David.
Thanks. It's been a good week. You know, everything continues to grow. So, and I hit some marks this week just on being right about some of these things. So I always enjoy being right. That's always fun.
Being right is nice. Finally, proud pup parent, artist, and future Hollywood screenwriter, Mr. Kevin Berrios. What's up?
Chilling, man. I'm just going to second that on Grubb's pods this week. You know, I'm not a big NFL guy, but, you know, like, if you're from here, the Saints are in your blood. And so, like, I've been listening to a lot to him and Ross Jackson's podcasts, and they've been really informative and really good, getting me prepared for going hang out with my friends whenever that becomes a thing again to watch Saints games. So those have been really good. I really enjoyed that pairing a lot.
Yeah, so make Ross sure you
is so cool.
Yeah, I mean, you two together are great.
Yeah, Ross Jackson, make sure you guys subscribe Locked On Saints as well as Hard in the Paint. Let's go ahead and get started, you guys. We'll start with, as the coaches turn, Ty Lue is said to be closing in on a deal with Philadelphia. Steve Nash shocked the world by agreeing to coach Brooklyn. Ollie, we talked to a lot of people, former athletes, media members, who pretty much all said that Ty Lue to NOLA was not necessarily a lock, but a strong candidate for the position. Were you surprised at this news of him going to Philadelphia? Do you think this changes anything at all for Griffin during his search?
No, not at all. I never felt that Ty Lue was honestly a strong candidate for the New Orleans position, because let's face it. I mean, I know, of course, they have a relationship, but the thing of the matter is the Pelicans are a growing team that need a lot of player development. And honestly, Ty Lue doesn't really have any of that in his back pocket. So I just never liked the idea of what he brought to the table for the Pelicans. So no, that was never a problem for me. And honestly, whenever you guys, I'm sure what we've probably discussed this on a previous podcast, but when you hear the names first come out, as soon as a coach gets fired, the first names that come out generally aren't going to be that list isn't going to be the same just 2-3 weeks later, because the ones that jump out at first are the ones that are looking for jobs and they have agents trying to promote them, you know, trying to get their name out in circulation because, you know, their clients are looking for jobs like the Jason Kidds, like, you know, the Mark Jacksons. And, you know, I hate to say it, but I'm going to throw Ty Lue in there simply because, you know, he wants another head coaching job too, right? Leading LeBron. Now he's sitting on the bench, albeit a good team and a great coach, Doc Rivers, but he wants his own gig too.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think of the fit in Ty Lue in Philadelphia?
You know, I fear for any coach going to that situation because we've talked about amongst ourselves and, you know, probably you want to ask this to Grubb because he feels the most passionate about it. But look, that roster, even though they have such good talent, it's just a mishmash of, you know, where you've got a couple of young guys, Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid, but you wonder, will they ever hit their peak or close to it? And then do they work together? And of course, you've got these incredibly too rich contracts sitting there, Al Horford and Tobias Harris. So they've kind of blown their wads, so to speak, when Philadelphia was in such prime position after Hanky tore it apart. They had all these assets that they accumulated over the years too. Suddenly they got spent and now, you know, they're basically their cupboard is dry and now they're stuck with this team that you don't know what they are. What can you turn them into? Can you even turn them into, like, say, a top four seed in the East? So I think any coach that goes over there is just going to have a tough time because I just think that, you know, between the desire of some players and to their personalities, I just don't think it mixes well. So, yeah, I feel, you know, if anybody can maybe make it work, it would be like a Ty Lue, right, who supposedly can grab the ear of any player, especially like a star. But, you know, I just think Joel Embiid, you know, walks to his own tune. Ben Simmons, I'm not even sure what that kid's about. Like I said, I want David to chime in on this as well. But yeah, I feel bad for Tyler. I don't think anybody can save that, you know, that franchise with that current roster.
Go ahead, Grubb. Talk about Ty Lue and Philadelphia and whether or not you think he can get into the ear of these guys.
No, I don't. And it's not on Ty Lue. I just think that, you know, the one thing that I've harped on the most is when you talk about culture. And we're seeing that play out in the playoffs right now with Miami. And people are resonating with what they're seeing from that team that as an individual group, you wouldn't be really excited about. But as a collective, you're seeing how good they are. And I think with Philadelphia, the sum is less than, you know, the total of its parts because those guys just don't fit. And then at Elton Brand, it feels like he's making desperation moves because he knows the Philly public is getting upset. And he's trying to fix this really quickly. And when you make moves like that, when you do things to try to turn your franchise really quickly, it usually ends up going left rather than the direction you're trying to point it in. And I just think that's where Philly is. I don't blame Ty Lue. You want to get back into it. You feel like you have a team that's ready to compete and go a long way, but you have two pieces that don't work well together. And then on top, who are supposed to be your franchise cornerstones. And on top of that, you've doled out all this money to two supporting players in Tobias Harris and Al Horford that cripple you because no one is going to take on those deals in this NBA economy. So I just think Philly is what it is. And it wouldn't matter if they had Brett Auerbach on the sidelines. They've peaked.
All right, Kevin, I want to transition over to Steve Nash now. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about with Steve Nash. It was a polarizing hire because, frankly, none of us were prepared for it. It was shocking in many respects. However, he's not the first point guard to kind of come out of nowhere to get a coaching job without any experience as an assistant. The ones that come to mind are Isaiah Thomas, who was previously an executive, Steve Kerr, Derek Fisher, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Jason Kidd. One thing that all of these players have in common was they all played point guard. Do you think there's some kind of, do you think front offices unfairly, so to speak, kind of adhere to point guards versus other positions like, say, a Jerry Stackhouse, who is a small forward for predominantly, a Patrick Ewing, who is a center? Why do front offices zero in on point guards?
Well, the point guard is the guy that initiates the offense, basically, you know, so he's the guy that runs the show on the team, you know, knows how to get other people going, knows how to get himself going, knows how to get people in their spot to get their shots. So naturally, that's it seems like a natural progression from that position to coaching more than any other position, more, you know, as a head coach, it seems, because it's all about dictating the flow of the offense, and usually being kind of a, usually a vocal leader from the point guard position as well. So I think that's just like a natural thing. That's what the position lends itself to. But now, you know, in the current NBA, you're starting to see guys being playmakers from other positions and creators from other positions. So I think that might start to shift, you know, because you have point forwards, you got guys like Jokic creating from the center position. So it's going to be interesting in the next, you know, several years to see how that shifts a little bit. But for now, it's understandable.
Now, Ali, I'm going to put this towards you. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion on Twitter about the hiring of Steve Nash, being that there's so many qualified African-American candidates. And I think there's only four positions taken by African-Americans with the removal of Jacques Vaughn, Alvin Gentry. Of course, we're not privy to what happened behind the scenes. And of course, it's not Brooklyn's fault that there's only four African-American coaches throughout the NBA. But what was your reaction to Steve Nash seemingly coming out of nowhere when this year there were so many qualified African-American coaches who seemed to be on the short list for these positions?
Yeah, I mean, I'm torn, as we've all discussed, you know, behind the scenes. You know, on the one, I mean, you can see both arguments, right? I'll speak to the first one regarding, you know, to where, why he should have gotten a job. And I've listened to a lot of podcasts, including Sean Marks, you know, joining Woj, Lloyd Pierce, talking with Howard Beck. And one thing you quickly learn is that Steve Nash isn't just some common guy, basically off the streets, that they just handed a guy with no experience a prime job. You know, there's been a lot of, like, and he's not the first, to where he's coming from a great background, right? Where he's a qualified mind because he was one of the best point guards. And as we know, point guards are these, they have a leadership quality. A lot of them do to them. They understand the game. They see it differently. So they make for, you know, really good coaches. I mean, you don't have to look too far back in history to see that, right? Doc Rivers, he jumped right to the position out of the broadcast booth. Mark Jackson. I know Larry Bird wasn't a point guard, but he applies. He had that success with Indiana. There's been Isaiah Thomas, Steve Kerr, Derek Fisher, Jason Kidd. So Nash is hardly the first. And if you look at that list of names I even mentioned, guess what? A lot of those guys did actually fairly well. And probably the guy that did the worst, right, Derek Fisher, he struggled, but it was with the Knicks, right, 2 years. And now, if you want to hold that against him as maybe being a bad coach, look what he did with his first season in WNBA, right? He led the LA Sparks to a championship. So maybe he is a really good coach. So I don't have a problem per se with choosing Steve Nash. And if you listen to Lloyd Pierce especially, I mean, he points out all the reasons why you should be ecstatic over the hire, because he is one of those exclusive special minds that seem like they can basically make that jump. And you feel pretty confident, right? Nash is a great communicator. You saw that with all of his teams in Phoenix, right? He was always, I remember analysis would point out, like when they're leaving, going off the floor for a timeout, for instance, Nash is always tapping everybody, giving them, you know, some kind of motivational little speech, a sentence, a word, slapping them on the butt. And for those that know, that's really important. Like, for instance, in team camaraderie and stuff. So somebody has to have that position. So Nash, like I said, it just seems like an easy transition for him to move into a head coach. But of course, having said all that, you got to look at the downside. And as you guys know, I mean, there's a list, a long list of deserving candidates that are Black. And it's scary because over the last 20 years, for the most part, the amount of head coaches and GMs in the league between Blacks and whites was roughly the same. But lately, it's been slipping. You know, I just looked at a list. Now there's currently only six GMs that are Black heritage and only five head coaches. As to where before, it was usually vacillating between that like 9, 10, 11, kind of out of the 30 teams. So yeah, it's a little bit of a concern.
I want to continue this question, David Grubb, and I want to speak directly about Jacques Vaughn, who I think all things considered really performed admirably in his role. Obviously, he had to deal with the shift in the rotation between DeAndre Jordan and Jarrett Allen and lost, I think, eight of their critical rotation players heading into the bubble and still performed well. I think I see right here they won six of their last eight, 10 of their last 14 games, despite the odds. And now he's being relegated back to top assistant, although he's being made the highest paid one in the NBA. What was your reaction to him earning the role, filling it admirably, and then having that role taken away from him again?
May I first say two other things?
Sure, of course. Floor is yours.
First, as far as point guards, I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's just like baseball. They keep hiring catchers as managers. And they say, well, catchers see the game, and that's why they should be managers. Catchers and pitchers are always managers. That's a preconceived notion. It's no different to me than you know, people saying, well, there's no such thing as an inherent qualification. I don't think that. I think that there are a lot of big men who have been in this league as assistant coaches. They don't get the position because height is a discriminating factor. You don't see it on the college level either. You don't see forwards and centers as coaches. I think there's an inherent thing against taller people in those positions because they are more intimidating. They don't look the part. They look different. And so we do have preconceived notions about what a coach is and what they look like. And so you don't have a history of success or failure as deep with bigs, even though because they don't get the same opportunities. I mean, I could say Bill Russell won a championship as a center. I could say Alvin Attles won a championship as a center who became a head coach. I could say that, you've had Kevin McHale was a successful head coach as a forward / center for his career. But do any of those things change the perception that big men and power forwards should have head coaching jobs? I mean, I think that there's just a general sentiment that they don't belong. And I also think that it lends itself to a more difficult thing because those tend to be, and we see on the sidelines, the African-American coaches that get hired tend to be my shade for the most part. Ty Lue, Mark Jackson, the ones that we're talking about, the ones that have stayed around tend to be my shade. The ones that are darker, the Jock Vaughns, they don't really get the hires. You look around, there's a Lloyd Pierce, and then how many other dark-skinned African-Americans are head coaches? There are a couple of things that at play. I think that there are things that society is still dealing with that we see all summer that have played out in those hiring preconceptions too. The other side is, I just think that also in this case, Nash is not the correct arbiter of the person. I think people confuse the problem with this particular outcome. But as far as the Jacques Vaughn thing, my concern, and we talked about this, was how informed was Jacques Vaughn about the process? How informed was he that they were looking for outside candidates? Did he have a real chance at getting this job, or were they already looking at Nash and doing this as, like in the NFL, performance art with the Rooney Rule, that, hey, we gave Jacques this opportunity, we interviewed him, but we always were focused on Nash. Look, this is a relationship thing. If KD and Kyrie don't sign off on it, it doesn't happen. So I understand that part of it. But I just want to make sure that the ultimate thing is not fairness, because there is no such thing in the world, but equity, and that there's an opportunity and that it's real. That if they said one thing to Jacques Vaughn and did something else, then I'd want to know that for their integrity. But if this is the thing that they discussed with him and told him, hey, this is always our intention, and he understood that, then I'm okay with that.
Now, Kevin, thank you, by the way, Grubb, for covering my question as well as the point guard debate, because that was what I was tending to think as well. We tell ourselves that the point guard is the one who dictates the offense, so clearly they must be more qualified than any other position. And when you think of somebody like Patrick Ewing, and a lot of the offense did flow through him in his time in New York, and not only that, but he's also responsible in many ways for the defense. So I think there is a anyway, we'll go ahead and move on. I want to cover this, Kevin. Now that there's only, I think, four African American head coaches in the NBA, the Indiana
five
position.
Preston. I think there's five. Preston is five. Yeah.
Five. So, do you think that has any effect on the New Orleans Pelicans coaching search? We're going to get into Kenny Atkinson soon. Obviously, he's a popular candidate for both the jobs, whether Indiana, the Pelicans, and I'm forgetting if there are any other open positions. But do you think the NBA might get in the ear of these franchises and say, like, hey guys, we really would like for you to interview more African-American head coaches now that Steve Nash is in Brooklyn?
I mean, I don't know that the league would do that. I also think that if you look at the list of coaches that people are talking about, really Kenny Atkinson is really the only, unless, D'Antoni gets released, the only like big name white coach that's really being considered. Most other coaches right now that are out there or black coaches. You're talking about Stackhouse, Sam Cassell, Ty Lue. He's not officially hired in Philadelphia, Vanderpool, Adrian Griffin. So there's David Fizdale. you know, there's like a lot of really highly qualified black coaches. So I think you're going to see a lot of them get hired in this next wave because they're just the best available coaches that are out there. And I think, you know, there's, you know, obviously you would understand a team that's ready to compete hiring D'Antoni. And Atkinson is a, definitely a qualified coach that I'd be happy to have hired, but he's like sixth or seventh on my list. And I think he's, you know, I think people probably be more willing to take a risk on an assistant coach that they believe in right now than him. I think he might be sitting out a year and then coming back the next year kind of situation with him just to get some breathing space from what happened with the Nets. That sometimes tends to happen with coaches where that sort of thing happens, where the superstar kills their tenure. You see that happen pretty frequently. So yeah, I don't think it's going to be, I think like the next wave of hires is going to be very good for black coaches in the NBA. I mean, they have so many qualified ones that are being discussed and talked about and just seem like great fits for teams that are out there that I don't see why those guys wouldn't be getting jobs in this next round. Cause I don't think teams are going to look past what those guys can provide just because of skin color right now, you know, in this era, especially.
And you guys know that we have articles on thebirdwrites.com right now on Ty Lue, Sam Cassell, David Fizdale, Jerry Stackhouse, Mike D'Antoni. I know we've got more coming, so be sure to check that out. And check out our previous podcast where we spoke with Chris Connor about Jerry Stackhouse specifically. Ali, you wrote about Kenny Atkinson. Obviously, there's the Brooklyn ties with Trajan Langdon. David Griffin was very high on the Nets culture even before he was with the Pelicans. I remember on ESPN, he mentioned how he thought Kyrie Irving might be interested there because Kyrie did want to be in that kind of culture. So obviously he's been admiring Kenny Atkinson and his work there from afar. Do you think that gives Kenny Atkinson, let's say, the advantage at this point in time?
I do. I wanted to kind of touch on what Kevin was saying real quick, so I'll tie it all in together. You got to understand, I think, one reason why there's a drop, I think, in black head coaches. And Lloyd Pierce kind of discussed that. And it all has to do with just the amount that are in every single level of organizations, right? If there's going to be fewer GMs that are, you know, black or of some kind of minority background, then chances are it's probably going to show up in the head coaches as well, because everything is about relationships. He says the number one reason you get a job, and this is Lloyd Pierce was talking, is who you know. And he says, the reason I got a job in Atlanta is because I knew Travis Schlenk in with the Golden State Warriors while he was there for a little bit. And so they had like an immediate connection. On top of that, he was the right guy with the right qualifications at the right time. So he thinks that plays a big deal too, right? So where Atlanta, they're growing a really young cast. So you had to be really big in player development, right? That had to be one of your strengths, a good communicator, and several other things. So I think all that ties into and that matters. And so that's why I honestly think, even though, like, you know, Kenny Atkins is white, obviously, I feel like he is got a leg up because he does have prior relationship, not, I don't think, with David Griffin, but of course with Langdon. And there's several other pieces, components there as well, including, for instance, Will Weaver in Sydney, who worked on Atkinson's bench, who, of course, coached Didi over in Australia in the NBL. So I think all that does truly matter. And, you know, for Kenny, I mean, of course, those obvious ties and relationship, then he does check a lot of other boxes. He's known to be a great developer of talent. When I was researching him, I looked at every single stop, starting with the Rockets, where he first came over from Europe, and he was just a player development coach with the Rockets for 1 year, but he supposedly made a lot of inroads with Aaron Brooks. If, I don't know if people remember, he was one of the two point guards in Houston at the time when Kyle Lowry was there. And they often split some time together on the court. But Aaron Brooks went on to become a really good point guard and had an explosive season 1 year where he won Most Improved. I want to say it was in 2010. And then Atkinson went to other stops, did the same thing. Jeremy Lin in New York, Jeff Teague, and a lot of other players in Atlanta. And then, of course, with the Brooklyn Nets, what he did with D'Angelo Russell and the rest of that cast was just really impressive. You know, and it's not only what he does.
Okay. Go ahead, Ali. I'll go ahead. Go ahead.
What the hell was that?
Okay. That was Grubb's microphone, out. I think.
Oh, okay. I thought it was me. Sorry, I had a window open or something. But anyways, then so Kenny, he on top of that, you know, great developer of talent, to hear what players say about him, what almost anybody, not just players, but within organizations say about him, how he's such a respected, you know, person. And then, of course, a leader of locker rooms. People have, you know, given him so much credit for what he's done with X's and O's as a coach. And the best part is I think he runs a modern offense, right? He's an analytics guy. He loves the 3-and-D concept. He loves integrating the three-point shot. So when Houston Rockets were suddenly a couple of years ago averaging almost half of their shots were threes, guess who was right behind them? The Nets. And so I think Kenny just really ticks, like I said, all these check marks on your list to where I feel like he'd make for a great fit here in New Orleans. But please, I know I spoke a lot here, but there's 3,000 more words you can read about on the Bird Rights.
Yeah, we got a bunch of great stuff on there. Make sure you check that as well. Grubb, obviously it's natural after having like a very freestyle with Alvin Gentry and a guy who was a player's coach that next we would want a tougher coach, a defensive minded coach, because maybe that can take the Pelicans to a place they haven't gotten in the past 5 years. But just in terms of what we've seen from this postseason, does it change in your mind in any way the way that you'd like to see the Pelicans enact their offense and defensive style?
Like, that's the least important thing for me is style. I don't give a shit about style, me. You know, my thing is, like, what is your structure? Do you have a – because style should be adaptive. I don't like coaches who say, this is how I play. No, I want somebody like – again, when I focus on Miami, it's because they are amoeba-like. I believe it was – I'm trying to remember the writer for Yahoo Sports who was talking about this, and he said the reason that Giannis is attracted to Miami – is because Miami can adapt whether they have a superstar or not, whether they want to play up-tempo or slow. That's what I'm looking for. So I want a coach whose philosophy is I take the talents of my team and I adjust to them. And that's similar to what Mike D'Antoni, you could say that's what he did with the Rockets this year. He went all in on this small ball because he adapted to what he had. It's not the same team that he had last year or the year before. So, I mean, I think that you want a coach who's going to be flexible in their design, but consistent in their principles. And so the main thing for me is create a structure, create accountability, create real outcomes and a plan for each one of these players in this team to where is the path that you want to get to. But your talent is going to change each season. The configuration of your team is going to change, and you need to be able to adapt to that.
Yeah, we've seen some of the more respected coaches in the NBA, like Mike Budenholzer, stick to his system much in the same way that Alvin Gentry would stick to his offense, remaining big, keeping his guys at 34 to 35 minutes, not changing the way that he coaches. Where with Miami, you do see a guy like Eric Spoelstra in the middle of a game when they've played 50 games throughout the regular season, man-to-man, all of a sudden switching to his own. And his players are smart enough, and there's the culture, like you said, that's deep enough within them that they're able to adapt to those changes. I think we're at Kevin. So, Kevin, I want to continue with the same line of thought. Obviously, the Pelicans had that traditional big in Derek Favors, who was the anchor of their defense. However, when you take him off the floor, there's not a lot the Pelicans could really do. They didn't really have anybody to supplant him. Moving Zion to the five was pretty much a disaster defensively. When you talk about being adaptable, like the Pelicans would need to be in order to be a playoff team that can go head-to-head with a team like the Rockets as well as a team like the Lakers, what kind of player are you looking for?
Well, I want to just add a little bit to what Grubb was just saying. I agree 100%, and that's why I like a lot of coaches that have filled multiple roles in multiple organizations. Guys like Melvin Hunt, David Vanderpool, they've been a lot of stops. They've been scouts. Mm-hmm. They've been video guys. They've been assistant coaches. They've worked under numerous systems overseas. They've been on bad teams. They've been on good teams. So they've been exposed to a lot, and those guys seem to be more flexible and you know, structuring what their offense and defense is. So that's the kind of guy that I want. And so to answer your question, it's a little bit difficult in the sense, I mean, we know what we need. We need a rim protector, a rebounder, a screen setter for sure. You need another tweener forward that can space the floor some, so you don't have to constantly play Ingram at the four. So that can allow you to play Zion a little bit at the five. And then you need another veteran ball handler. So, I mean, But then again, we don't know who the coach is. We don't know what the system is. We don't know what we're doing with Drew Holiday yet. I think if you traded Drew Holiday to the Nets, you could fill a lot of those holes with what comes over there. Then that lends itself to maybe hiring Kenny Atkinson, getting some of those guys that were part of his original system that bought in and played with that culture or whatever. But I mean, I think there's a just because you make that trade doesn't mean you have to hire Kenny Atkinson. Like, I have full confidence in David Vanderpool or Wes Unseld Jr. or whoever working with those guys. But I think those are the main things you need. I think you definitely still need to get that rim protector and to improve rebounding, because those two things were a nightmare, and you need a great screen setter to free up some of those shooters. And I would say secondary to that is a tweener forward to help you out in smaller lineups.
2020 has been the year of things happening that are completely out of your control. But there is one thing you can control, and that's shaving your bush. Our sponsors at Manscaped are here to remind you to do so. The Manscaped Lawnmower 3.0 is a premium electric trimmer that's designed to give you a confidence boost through body image. Their ceramic blade and skin-safe technology are designed to reduce nicks or tugs on your fellows down low. The Lawnmower 3.0 is also waterproof and comes with an LED light, so you can manscape in the shower, in the dark, or in a dark shower, whatever floats your boat. They also just released their Shears 2.0 nail kit, which is the perfect add-on to their Lawnmower 3.0 trimmer. The Shears 2.0 nail kit allows you to pluck your eyebrows and trim your nails in style. On their website, you'll also find the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer. And this will help you tame that summer swamp ass with natural hydrators and antioxidants. You'll also find the Crop Reviver, a testy toner that's like having cologne that is designed for your balls. Go to manscaped.com and check out some of these life-changing products. In fact, listeners of this show will get 20% off plus free shipping with the code armchair at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com, and use the code armchair. It's time to grab 2020 by the horns by shaving that front trunk. As sports keeps coming back, so does your chance to bet on them with our exclusive wagering partner, betonline.ag. Major League Baseball and the NBA are in full swing, and there are no shortage of ways to get in on the action. BetOnline has all the odds, futures, and props for you to bet on. Also, tune in as Floyd Money Mayweather joins the BetOnline team in a new segment called The Ice is Right, where he talks about his expansive jewelry collection. He'll give you the chance to win some great prizes and bet on the cost of his bling. Visit betonline.ag today to check out all the odds and up-to-date sports news. Don't forget to sign up and take advantage of all the Welcome Back to Sports bonuses. BetOnline, your online wagering experts.
Yeah, for sure. Versatility is critical. And the Pelicans have a big hole there, and they've got a lot of questions with how to fill it, not just in terms of Derek Favors, but also, as you mentioned, Drew Holiday. And Ollie, there's a lot of teams in the NBA bubble right now that looks like they could use a guy like Drew Holiday. I'm specifically speaking about the Milwaukee Bucks. Obviously, if you bring in a veteran coach like a Kenny Atkinson, you would think that he would want to have Drew Holiday around, because a veteran like him is, you would think, would be more prone to winning than adding a young guy like, I don't know, Dante DiVincenzo, for example, the first name that comes to mind. Just in terms of what we've seen in the bubble, does it change your perspective about how valuable Drew Holiday would be to a contending team?
Are you basically asking me, do I see suddenly his value
rising
up with the play we've seen?
Yeah, because I think at last year, his value was at an all-time high. You know, we had that rumor mill about Kawhi Leonard potentially being interested in him, or at least Los Angeles trying to pair him with Kawhi Leonard. And then as this season continued on, it felt like his stock dropped as the Pelicans, you know, lost 13 games in a row. Of course, they had that nice streak at the end, but just in terms of what he's able to do in terms of closing games, you saw his stock drop a little bit there. But now you've got Andre Iguodala, on what podcast was it? Was it the Bill Simmons podcast, saying that he should be a candidate for Defensive Player of the Year every year? He should be a first-time all-defender every single year. And we see supplementary role players like Eric Bledsoe just shirking from the moment in a place like Milwaukee, where you could use that secondary playmaker. In your mind, when you see all these teams that will be desperate this free agency to acquire a difference maker like Holiday, do you see his stock rising?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I don't think it ever truly slipped, you know, because his play is what it's been for the last 4 years. I mean, I know there was kind of the biggest high was right when the Pelicans rode into the last playoffs, and of course his first round performance against the Blazers. But you know what? Drew has always been a lot more inconsistent than that guy. I mean, that's just who he is. if you watch every game, I'm sure you've picked up on that by now. A lot of Pelicans fans know that anyways, to where, yeah, the defense is always going to be a given. It's always going to be top notch. But the offense, right, it comes and it goes, to where his effectiveness, even within games, it vacillates a lot, right? He'll have a great first half. I sat next to David Grubb in the arena plenty of times, and we were just like, okay, Drew just had a good first half. We're probably not going to see much in the way of points or production in the second half, and it's almost always held true. That just, you know, his consistency, that's just who he is, because he just doesn't have, you know, that talent to be a team's, you know, first option on offense every single time down the floor. He's always a guy that's kind of needed that flow to get into stuff. But anyways, we're rehashing an old argument. Everybody should know that by now if you've been listening to our podcast over the years. But no, there are going to be teams that are going to be desperate for a talent like Drew Holiday, right? He can be a difference maker. And so, I mean, the obvious choice, of course, is the Nets. I think I personally love the idea of him going up there, playing next to Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant, because whoever's going to be the third guy in Brooklyn is without a doubt going to lose shots. He's going to have to basically fill a role, just like Chris Bosh has and certain other teams, to where, you know, I'm not sure Caris LeVert is willing to do that. You know, he's 25. He's still in an upward trajectory. Can he even fulfill that role, right? You know that he could probably lead a team or Brooklyn's team on offense off the bench, but does he want to be like a Manu Ginobili role? But I think as to where a guy like Drew Holiday, there's no question that he would fit in and do what's necessary. So say if it's not Brooklyn, maybe Miami, right? I mean, who knows how far Miami's going to go, because the way they're playing right now, you can conceivably see him making it to the NBA Finals, right? I mean, they've got the Milwaukee Bucks on the ropes, and deservedly so. I mean, could Milwaukee, as you were just mentioning, Preston, take Drew? I'm not so sure I like him up there. I feel like they need somebody that's a lot more aggressive. Chris Middleton, you know, he's another guy that people love when he's playing well, talk about him being like one of the top, you know, 15 players in the league. I don't think he's that guy. I think he's more like top 30, 35, to where he's a lot like Drew, to where you can't count on him for every, you know, every big game. And he's kind of been missing for Milwaukee. You know, Giannis is going to do Giannis, but he's still got holes in his game. So I don't feel like those two are necessarily the best compliments. They still need that third, like a Jamal Murray. Like they need somebody that's just, you know, can shoot daggers and has that mindset, right, to where he wants to run through walls. So I don't think that's Drew for Milwaukee. But, you know, you could see him end up somewhere else. It depends on how this whole playoff shakes out. But, yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of good suitors chasing Drew this free agency period. And you wonder, will David Griffin pounce on it? And, you know, we're going to go into it in future pods. I know once we get past all these coaches, we're going to do like what we did last year, guys, with Anthony Davis. We're going to list, like, say, maybe pick 5-6 teams that are likely landing spots and come up with trade scenarios for each team involving Drew. So stay tuned.
All right. Well, we'll keep that for later. I was going to continue in on that line of questioning, but I'll just go to Grubb and focus on what coach you would like to see in New Orleans. Obviously, so much is going to be dictated over how the playoffs play out, because you would imagine that, I don't know, if one of these assistants like overperforms, like I don't know who's on the staff in Miami, but just from what we're seeing from them, you would think somebody on the staff there, his value would rise. Do you think the Pelican search is still evolving, David, based on how these teams are performing in the bubble?
I think there's still so many other factors that we have to see at play. I think, you know, coaches who are still available or who pull their names out are going to, you know, change things. I think as hirings go, depends on how it falls, how quickly other teams snatch up people. That always is a factor. But I think that they're, and how people assemble their staff, if some of these candidates go on and become lead assistants with another coach early on, because they look for the security of it rather than having to wait for the process to play out. But I think Griffin knows that he has to hit a home run with this, not in a PR sense, but with the performance. I think they'll be very deliberate. I do think that they will look at someone who comes in. I think that they will be broad with their search, that they will allow themselves to be wowed. And I think that's the most important thing you want to see from a front office, is that they don't have a preconceived notion about, okay, we're focusing on these three guys. No, give yourself the opportunity to be impressed. You know what I mean? So I think that Griffin, Swin, and Trajan, that whole group up there, along with Mrs. Benson. She will trust them certainly to make the decision and the recommendation, but she's got to sign off on it. So I think that they will do their due diligence over the course of time. I would expect that it probably takes a little bit longer than we think for the Pelicans to make a hire.
And to his credit, that's what David Griffin said to us in his press conference after announcing the removal of Alvin Gentry from the head coaching position. So that's good to hear.
I got a quick question for you guys. Why do you think do you think by any chance, like say if he goes Kenny Atkinson and then, or he's thinking about Kenny Atkinson, but then say they decide to make a trade to where Drew Holiday goes, of course, to the Brooklyn Nets and pieces come back. Do you think that would make Griffin more likely than to hire Atkinson? Do you think he's thinking about scenarios like that, or is that just me overthinking it?
I mean, if that were the case, wouldn't you also be thinking like, well, I mean, relationships, you could also be pushing for a guy like Jerry Stackhouse, who's gotten the college season is so far pushed back. You know, the college basketball season may not start till January. So you have more time with Stackhouse because he doesn't have to do those things. So, you know, his relationship with Brandon Ingram. So I think that all helps too, to not have to force it and grab somebody really quickly. I think Atkinson too, the jobs that are available now for a guy like Kenny Atkinson, New Orleans is clearly the most attractive job on that list. Because why would you want to go back to a Chicago which has more building to do? Why would you want to go backwards to one of the, or, you know, to one of these other jobs that are more difficult financially, more difficult talent wise, more difficult roster wise? So if I'm Kenny Atkinson, there's no rush for me either, because the only job that I'm focused on this year, like you said, he may take a whole year off, is the New Orleans job. It's either New Orleans or nothing. So he's not in a rush anyway.
I would disagree slightly, just because the more I think about that Pacers job, the more attractive it is. You know, they have a lot of good players there. You got Brogdon, Sabonis, Turner. You know, Oladipo is probably getting traded, so you're going to get pieces back from that. TJ Warren, of course. So there's a lot, and then they have a culture of winning already established there. So I think that job would also be very attractive to a guy like Kenny Atkinson as well. But, I mean, I understand everything else he said, of course, and especially if, you know, he has a really tight bond with whatever pieces would be coming back from a Nets trade, if they make that trade before the hire, or if they tell the candidates that this is the move we got planned or whatever, you know, obviously that becomes possibly more attractive to him too. But, you know, this situation is obviously a good situation because you have Ingram and Zion and then a bunch of assets that can be moved or kept and groomed. So there's a lot to be excited about there.
Kevin, let me follow up with you. Obviously the Pelicans are doing things the right way, being patient, you know, letting these head coaching candidates come to them, wow them. From the other side of this, they do potentially only have 3 months until the regular season starts. And there's a lot of groundwork that could be laid right now, not just with the players, but also in hiring assistants. The longer we go on, the more some of these guys who are available are going to be snatched up. And maybe that's the goal all along, because Griff did say he wanted to keep some of those guys in-house. But do you get nervous that the later this search goes on, the less time a head coach can spend with the Pelicans roster, with having these critical conversations, with assembling a staff? Do you get nervous that time is being wasted?
I mean, that's definitely a concern, that, you know, the longer you take, the harder it is for him to assemble the staff that he wants, or get to know the staff that is retained, to get to know the players. But I mean, these guys study film. They know players. They have ideas coming into what they want to do with those players. I mean, when they're pitching for the job, they're going to have a plan set to show David Griffin what they want to do with the roster, how they want to run the offense, how they think they could get better play out of each guy, and these sort of things. So it's not as bad as people think, but obviously if you have more time to work with the people that you're going to be working with, the more comfortable, the more in alignment you'll be when the regular season starts. But, you know, with this process that we're going through, I think you have to understand that it's going to, you know, it's, you can't expect success right off the bat. You have to give them leeway to get those things in alignment anyway. So in this first season, I wouldn't worry about it so much, because you're really making this hire for the long run and not so much the first season. You can afford some growing pains early on in the season and still build to what your ultimate goal is. And, you know, like Grubb said, the main thing is establishing a culture and figuring out the identity of this team. And that's what you want to do this first season.
All right, Ollie, we already mentioned Kenny Atkinson and why he might be potentially your favorite for the role based on his history and on his track record. However, like Kevin just said, that Indiana Pacers job is a pretty good one, too. And they played pretty well this season, even with the inconsistency to Victor Oladipo. And there's no telling what his future is there or what they might be able to get back from him. He still has a year remaining on his deal. Are you nervous that the Pacers could kind of hone in on Kenny Atkinson and remove him from the board?
No, I honestly don't. I think, first of all, I think David Griffin's got a list of names that he would be happy with, any single one of them. I don't know how long the list is. Nobody does outside of him and a few others, but I don't think he would be brokenhearted. I honestly think the reason he's taking until you know, we get to the draft and free agency is because he wants to see how certain things play out. I think he's trying to take advantage of however the roster were to shake out, whether, you know, through the draft or free agency, depending on what happens with any possible trades, like I mentioned with Drew. So I really think all that is under consideration, and therefore that's why Pelicans are going to jump into a coach right now. And let's face it, who knows when the season's going to start, but I don't think it's a concern at all about there not being enough time to assimilate with your new coaching staff and the players and all that. I think there's going to be plenty of that time. I think he knew that when he made that announcement right after Alvin Gentry got fired in the last media conference call. So I think, you know, that's one thing we've learned about Griff. I feel like he's super thorough, attention to detail, bar none, and he's highly, you know, analytical in his approach. So I think, honestly, he's not going to make a mistake like that. So, but as far as Kenny going to the Indiana Pacers, you know, I wouldn't see why they would, because you got to think whoever Indiana's going to be looking for has to be somebody that's more ready to take a roster now and be something more than just a first-round playoff contender, right? Atkinson's really not your guy. I mean, yeah, you still can do some more development. They've got enough decent young guys. But I just don't feel like Kenny's the perfect fit for them like it would be here in New Orleans or maybe even the Chicago Bulls. So, no, I'm not worried about that one at all. But, you know, I hope we get to some really good names because Kenny's not the only one that's high on my board, right? I mean, I'm just going to say I agree with what Grubb says a lot. You got to kind of determine what you want this culture, this everything to be. You can't just pick certain guys, whether it's like coach and players, and say, okay, figure it out, come up with the best plan type of deal. No, you kind of want some kind of direction. But I think there's a lot of coaches that can bring you that. It just depends which way you want to go. So besides Atkinson, I mean, I would love to see either Jerry Stackhouse or David Vanterpool be given serious consideration for this job.
Now, Grubb wrote about David Fizdale, and obviously building a culture is paramount, and you spoke about how Eric Spoelstra has been able to do that in Miami under Pat Riley's leadership. But just in terms of what David Griffin's going to be hearing, you said you want him to be wowed, or you want him to give candidates the opportunity to be wowed. What kind of presentation would wow you?
It's somebody who comes in and has looked at this roster already, you know, has researched it, comes in and says, here's what I expect out of Lil Ball this year. Skill-wise, not numbers. I don't want you to come in and tell me what his numbers are going to be. But skill-wise, this is what I want. Here's what I want to see out of Zion Williamson this year. Here's what I want to see out of Brandon Ingram. I want 15 different ideas. Not fully developed plans. You haven't worked with them. But you know what? I want you to come in with that. You know, come in with an idea of how you're going to use the G League team. Because you are the de facto leader of that too. So talk about that plan for development in that group. How are you going, particularly with these guys like Jackson Hayes or Naw or whomever, how are you going to utilize a shuttle system between those? Are you going to? I want to know about those things. I want you to talk about your locker room. Who do you see as this team as leaders? Is there a leadership deficiency in your mind? Do you need to bring in more veteran help? You know, what are the things that you see already with this team? So that's what I'm looking for, is somebody who has a scope and a vision to come in and supplement what Griffin's long-term goals are, and then also has some detailed thing to present to the public and say, what is the baseline for next year? He and Griffin need to have a baseline, because the fans, you can't say we've had progress and come out with 27 wins next year. You know what I mean? You won't be able to justify it in that manner. So you want to have some idea of some concrete baseline, because you can't have a successful business without a business plan. And that's part of it. What are the results? How, what's the timetable internally? I mean, that's something they don't need to explain, but inside they should have a timetable. They should have an understanding of when is this team going to be at its peak, and when do, how do we accelerate that, or how do we slow that down financially? All the things that you're looking at. So that's what I'm, somebody who, like Kevin says, has that understanding of all facets of the organization, has a plan for their assistants, is not necessarily a micromanager, but somebody who is a leader of people. So those are the things that that I'm kind of looking for, is somebody who just comes in and knows, already knows what they want out of the job, and are not waiting to be told necessarily, you know, what, you know, like coming in on a job interview and saying, well, I want to work hard, and I really, you know, I'm a great worker and I have ideas. No, I want this job because you need me to take your team to that level. Someone with that kind of confidence, that kind of purpose, and that kind of understanding.
Yeah, that was really well said, in terms of not only instilling a culture, but also with the guys that we have right now on the roster, and what you can do, how you can improve their games, how you can develop them. Something we didn't really see, in my opinion, with Nickeil Alexander-Walker and Jackson Hayes, after seeing how impressive they were in summer league. You wanted to see them take that next step throughout the regular season. However, I don't think we saw a lot of that. And one of those things that we didn't get to experience was Nickeil Alexander-Walker playing in the G League. I think he played just two games there. Maybe that time to develop could have been good for him. Who's to say? But having somebody in that position who can make those decisions, who has a plan, could obviously benefit these guys long term. Just in terms of bringing that plan forward, Kevin, how much would an incoming coach have to say in terms of keeping guys like Lonzo Ball, who's been in trade rumors, Drew Holiday, who's going to continue being in trade rumors until he signs an extension? If a coach comes in here with a definitive plan, do you think that changes David Griffin or Trajan Langdon's perspective on whether or not to move those guys?
I don't know if it changes it. I mean, if a guy comes in with a clear plan on how he can make a player work in his system, and how he has a clear set of goals on how to improve them, it may make them second guess a move. But if they want to make a move, if they are getting if they're getting the assets back that they think are fair or a win for them, then they're going to make that move, because that's what they do. I mean, they're constantly trying to make the team better. So I don't think it's necessarily going to change because a coach has a plan to improve a guy that's on the roster when they think they can improve the roster as a whole by moving that guy. I don't necessarily think it affects it that much. Now, if the coach is like, this guy is crucial to what I do, and is very adamant about it, perhaps. But I really don't see that being that much of a factor. I think, you know, more likely the factor that the coach will have is discussing possible returns. You know, if they have different options on a return, they might get the coach's input on what he thinks he can work with the best. But in terms of deciding on moving away from a guy, I don't think the coach is going to have that much of an input.
I want to thank you guys for your questions, Willimbo, Finn, the Human, Slim Reaper, Ethan, and one that we'll get into, Will's question: is it time for new jerseys? I think that's a good question. I know David and Kevin have been passionate about that. Ollie, what's your take on new jerseys? Obviously, the Pelicans had the Mardi Gras themed one. They've got the red. They've got the navy. Do you think it's time for a makeover?
I would love to see the navy disappear, honestly.
Like
the
red one. I mean, that's a consensus.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's an easy consensus. I haven't met anybody that said to the contrary. But yeah, something along the Mardi Gras, the city edition, something along where it's just, you know, represents the city better. And everybody loves that look. So why not wear that jersey more often?
Yeah, Grub, I'll let you continue that. You had some good takes on that. Obviously, the navy needs to go. What needs to take its place?
I think you use the red as the primary road uniform always. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. The thing that I don't like about the white is the gold trim where it is. Like, there's something that needs to be more bold about the white that needs to make it pop. It doesn't really pop. It doesn't feel, the white one needs to feel more New Orleans. You know what I mean? And I think that there's a way to
do
that.
I'm
just not sure. I'm not conceiving it under the current structure of the uniform. I don't see how it is there, but there's something that they need to do with that. Eliminate the navy entirely. I would prefer not to do another Mardi Gras because it's been, to me, it's been done. You know, you see other cities like New York and Chicago, and even, you know, it's one thing from Miami's, which is like so vibrant when you see it. The New Orleans one is kind of like very specific, but it's also specific to a time of year and not the culture. You know what I mean? I'd like to see something that is, that makes you feel more like New Orleans feels throughout the year. And I don't, again, that's a concept.
You don't think, David, I got to disagree with you. You don't think that when anybody comes to New Orleans, or even tourists, people that live here, don't tourists, live life fully year round, they don't get on Mardi Gras.
No, I don't live like Mardi Gras year round. I don't like Mardi Gras.
None of
I know
us
a lot
do,
of people
but I'm
from
saying
New Orleans
in terms of
like
appreciation of the culture, no. The heritage, I do it year round.
Mardi Gras?
No, not Mardi Gras. I'm saying,
but that's what I'm saying.
Like,
but that's what I'm saying. The shirt, the jersey needs to feel like the city more year round.
I feel like the jersey does.
Because the Mardi Gras, the Mardi Gras vibe is not New Orleans year round. I don't think that does. That's not New Orleans to me, Kevin. I would probably prefer to. But I think I'm just, to me, Mardi Gras is the most stereotypical New Orleans. It is the NCIS New Orleans. It's the you know, all the bad movies from the 80s where everybody spoke Cajun when you came to New Orleans. That's what that's what the Mardi Gras jersey feels like to me.
Kevin, break the tie.
Yeah, I agree 100% with Grubb. I'm so sick of the Mardi Gras uniform. But I mean, I would say that this more recent one is definitely the best one that they've had so far. But I mean, it's just, I agree with Grubb 100%. It's just the low-hanging fruit to grab that and run with it. And it doesn't really – you know, it's like an outside – you hired an outside marketing firm to brand your thing, and they're just like, oh, New Orleans, Mardi Gras, that's it, you know. And, like, it could even be something that reflected Mardi Gras, but something that dug deeper behind – like, peeled the onion back a little bit more and got more interesting, more on the ground level than just the you know – obvious color scheme of Mardi Gras. You know, if you did something that was based off
flambeaux
based off of the uniforms of the second line band, brass bands, you did something that was based off of Mardi Gras. I mean, you had Won't Bow Down as your slogan this year. Why not have a beaded applique lettering or in numbers like that to represent Mardi Gras Indians, something like that. You know, there's a lot of stuff. I'm very into the idea of shifting more to celebrate some of our musical artists, you know, whether that's, you want to go like the Fats Domino, Alan Toussaint route, or you want to go Cash Money, No Limit Records route. I think those would be great. Those would be very popular. Stuff like that would be great. The first thing I would do, besides getting rid of the blue, which you guys are totally right about the blue, is change the typeface. I get the idea behind the typeface. I like that they tried to do something where they tried to do something that incorporated the wrought iron railings and fences and stuff. The idea behind it was cool. The execution doesn't work because certain numbers don't even have that little barb. I mean, it used to drive me crazy as a graphic designer looking at Anthony Davis's jersey because he was number 23 and 2 doesn't have the barb, but 3 does. So it just looks like, it looks like, you know, you cut out different typefaces from a magazine and stuck it on his jersey. So there's just like a lot of things. And I hate that big, wide, like triangle shape on the shorts like that.
On the sides.
Yeah. That's just bad. I mean, they can do a lot more. Things I think about with the white jersey is possibly adding in a pinstripe but not like a real dominant pinstripe, something like either glossy white or like silver or a gold, but like a sort of muted gold can make it pop more. But yeah, it's definitely time for a remake on the branding. I think they really dropped the ball on the branding when this came out. I mean, go to the team store, everything just has the same stuff on it. It's not really diverse. And like, I'm a passionate Pels fan, but I'm also a graphic designer. So I go to the team store and I would love to throw $40 on a t-shirt, but there's no t-shirt that I think is designed well, that I think looks good, that I want to wear. So, you know, that becomes an issue. So I do think they need to really invest in fixing the graphic design elements of this team.
Or they should just hire you and Grubb.
I mean, they don't have to do that. There's a lot of really qualified people that can get it done. I just think it feels like they rushed it, and they also hired an outside firm that's not from here that, you know, just went with some low-hanging fruit there. But, yeah.
Yeah, there. I think Kevin's right. There's so many creative ideas to take from. And for each, because you see, like, New York has gone fire department. They've gone, you know, just old stuff. They've changed designs. Mm-hmm. With their city uniform every year, and there's like enough variation to it that, again, it drives purchases. And that's what you want too. Is some, the Pelican stuff is not really appealing to kids who don't live in New Orleans either. And that's what you have to make it too. Is I think they should, the primary logo with the wings all the way out, don't use that one as the primary logo anymore. Like, I think the one, the New Orleans, the Crescent City basketball one.
Yeah, we always talked about that.
For sure.
The primary, where it's just the bird head that, you know, that we like, those mm-hmm. two are much more clean mm-hmm. in their presentation than that big broad bird. Because yeah. it doesn't look good on a shirt, it doesn't look good on a hat. You know what I mean? It just it defeats the purpose of trying to be something that catches your eye. And the Pelicans just have a logo right now that doesn't that element that and the way the jersey designs. Yeah, it's hard to get casual people excited because one of the things casual fans want is gear that pops.
Yeah, and also, like, going back to your point is, like, you know, obviously Zion's going to sell a ton of jerseys, but, like, using the Mardi Gras thing, purple, green, and gold are kind of an ugly color combination. We're, like, cool with it because we're so used to it in our culture of seeing it all the time, but somebody from the outside – like, they're not going to want to wear that those colors together, those clashing colors, and try to match that with something else. So, you know, if you come up with something more interesting, I think you could sell a lot more and drive a lot more revenue to your team.
All right, great stuff, you guys. That's all the time we have for now. Remember, if you guys like the show, just retweet, share, rate us on iTunes. Of course, do the same for Harden the Paint and our friend Ross Jackson at Locked On Saints. You can also take somebody else's phone and rate on theirs. Ollie, you've got that Kenny Atkinson piece. What else are you working on?
I'm going to do a look at Jay Wright. I know that Jamal is looking at Vanterpool. And we'll have probably, I think, what are you thinking of doing one on Darvin Ham? Or no, that was somebody else. But anyways, yeah, we're going to do a few more coaching pieces. Then we're going to start looking, of course, at free agency and especially Drew Holiday trade destinations.
Exciting stuff. David, obviously, you've got your podcast every day, Hard in the Paint. What else am I forgetting?
Mondays and Wednesdays, I'm on KYOK Radio in Houston from 12 to 2 on the lunch break. And I'm working on MA Udoka, and I'm trying to have it done for tomorrow.
That's
so
right.
Ollie can have it up either tomorrow evening or Monday. So, yeah, Emi Udoka, I'm working on him. And I think he's another one of those candidates that not a lot of people know outside of the league. I mean, as far as fans go, but every coach in the league talks him up. So fans really should pay attention to him. And he's also – he was born 2 days and 2 years after me, so he's a Leo, and I like that.
speaking of Leos, Kevin Berrios, what's going on with you, man?
I'm looking forward to reading Jamal's piece. Because I'm a huge Vanderpool fan, and I've done, you know, lots of research on him. He's my top choice for Pelicans coach, so I want to see what somebody else has to say about it. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Would you like to co-write that with Jamal? I never even thought of asking you guys.
I sent Jamal a bunch of stuff that I had, like, I gave him a bunch of, like, video clips and interviews and clippings for him to write that. So, I mean, if he wants me to help him, I'll help him, but I think, you know, I'd like to see what he's going to do with it, to see, you know, an outside perspective from what I've, you know, my own thoughts.
Cool.
All right. Great stuff. You guys, thanks for listening. We'll have another pod. We've actually got two pods coming next week. I'll be talking with PJ Washington and the host of, oh my God, it's losing me. Anyway, it's about the Tim Donaghy scandal and how perhaps the NBA is not being truthful about it and how there could be other aspects to it that we'll hope to unveil once we bring the host on for you guys. Hopefully you'll find that entertaining, but for now,
as a Kings fan from that era, I'm definitely interested in that. Cause man, that I feel like that guy cost me a chance at a championship.
Yeah. Well said. He's going to talk about Scott Foster as well. So I'll keep you guys updated on that, but for now let's dance. Let's go Pels.
for listening to The Bird Calls on the Armchair All-American Network. If you like what you're hearing, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes, retweet, share with your friends, and most importantly, subscribe today.